and welcome to the Happy Hour Symposium Number 2, a New Start podcast. My name is Amy, and in this episode, we are joined by Julie Emerson, who is the author of our newest book of poetry, 27 Stings, and Roxana Bigadaroff, who did the illustrations for this highly visual collection of 17 poems. 27 Stings is set for release in the fall this November. Emerson is a multimedia artist and writer who spent her time between Vancouver and Main Island, BC. Her work has been showcased at galleries across the Lower Mainland, and you can learn more from her website at julieemerson.com. Bigadaroff is an award-winning artist whose illustrations have appeared in several international publications, including The New Yorker and The Walrus. Her illustrations can be seen on the covers of The Angela Carter and Flannery O'Connor book series. More of Roxana's work can be viewed on her website at roxanamundy.ca. Now, dear listener and reader, let's cross over to the symposium.
Thank you, Amy. The title of the book, as you know, is 27 Stings. It comes from the ancient Roman writer Pliny, who wrote that 27 is the number of bee stings required to kill an enemy when bees were used as a weapon. I really wanted to have this book to have a strong graphic component, so I was very happy that New Star Books got Roxana Bigadaroff to do the cover and to do the illustrations inside too. And we thought today it would be fun for both of us to chat about the written and the visual aspects of the book. I'm going to start by telling you something about the book. I'm interested in the feelings and aspects of culture that lead people to make war. I wanted to understand war and to write about it. So I looked into Chinese culture from the 6th century BCE and classical Greek and Persian culture with Alexander the Great. I researched war in colonial Angola and the beginning of the Hundred Years' War in Europe and right up to drone warfare that we're experiencing right now. I wanted to find out especially about the roles of women in war. They're often used as pawns or as instigators of war. I'm interested in food, really interested in food, and the lack of it in war. So starvation was used as a weapon, and different weapons like poison and bees. I'm also interested in the rules for making war in different seasons and landscapes. I should say I've always been a pacifist, but I realized I'd not looked at the cultural history of war, so I did, and I wrote 17 poems about it. I think I'd like to start by asking Roxana a question first. I'm going to ask you about your illustrations because they're so wonderfully inventive and intuitive. Did you do some of your own research to create the illustrations?
Hi, thanks for having us, Amy. Yes, I did a lot of research for certain things. I need to see the look of a certain character, for example, or for accuracy of a period, but then I take my liberties from there. For example, there's an illustration of Alexander you mentioned, and he's wearing a shell helmet. The poem has him using murex shells, but a murex doesn't look good as a helmet, so I look to Renaissance shell helmets for that. But I don't draw from references directly. I look at tons of references, and then I just absorb them into my memory and imagination, and then it kind of gets regurgitated from there. Because visuals, I think, have to speak at an emotional level, or to your unconscious, and not be rational, not be just repeating what the writer said. But yet it has to work within the given limitations of the subject. So yes, to answer your question, yes, I do my research and reference, but then I kind of forget it.
Mm-hmm. I understand what you mean about it being more doing the research and then absorbing it and then having it come out in your own vision, mm-hmm. but not that literally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It looks like you've done a lot of research too. I learned quite a lot of hidden history from these poems. Yet they're quite visionary and observant too. It almost feels like you're time traveling or channeling. So how much of it is the work of your imagination and intuition?
A lot. In my case, especially for the classical stories from thousands of years ago, I found there were usually only a few sentences of information in the history about some of the conflicts, really not very much. So I would research the culture and imagine myself in the situation. So I'd be thinking, what would the people be doing? What would they be feeling, thinking? What would they be eating? For example, when I wrote about the first marathon 2,500 years ago, you know that the Greeks did this epic walk from the beach of Marathon after they were fighting the Persians. And they had to get to Athens on foot before the Persians could sail round the bend and get there. And I imagined what it would be like to be a soldier at that time, an Athenian soldier. And, you know, Greece was the cradle of democracy at the time, but one-third of the population of Athens was slaves. So I imagine that the soldier would, of course, have a slave accompanying him, carrying his food, carrying his weapons, as they both were fighting in this situation. And I imagined, entirely imagined, the soldier slave as being from Thrace, which was a place with a very interesting culture of its own. And I was especially fascinated by the women. People don't know very much about women in history, including the women who interacted with Alexander the Great. So in the 4th century BCE, Alexander conquered the Persians, but he was in awe of the Persian king Darius. He didn't kill him. He captured his family, including Darius's very young daughter. He had her raised to speak Greek, and then when she was 16, he married her. So I imagined entirely what life would be like for this girl, this Persian princess, who was used as a pawn in war.
Interesting.
Roxana, I've noticed that in your other work, too, you seem to be inspired or influenced by figures in mythology, not just in illustrations for this book, but in other of your books, too. How does mythology form such a strong and interesting part of your artwork?
I was raised with it in the house. I mean, my mother was really interested in mythology, but as psychology, but also I believe that myth is the soul's version of recorded history, so it's relegated to a deep collective memory or dream mind, whatever. So whether people realize it or not, they all relate to mythological themes and archetypes at an unconscious level. So even if they don't know, you know, exactly what mythic character they're looking at, it resonates somewhere. And also, I find the interesting part of myth and theater. Sorry, let me say that again. I find it very interesting how myth and theater are interwoven. So when I thought of the drama of war, and the whole idea of the theater of war, that's what they call particular strategies or battles are called theaters. So all war is drama, tragedy, and I want to always bring in a theatrical element to my work. So for this book, I used a lot of, I made them all like little stages, I guess. You could look at them that way. Some of them have masks, and some of them also look like artifacts, as if they're rebuilt out of the ruins of legends. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
And then I just remembered just one interesting thing. Sinead O'Connor had done a CD of Irish folk songs, ballads, and she said that songs are ghosts, and I think that goes for poems too. You know, they kind of have this tunnel to the past, depending on what you're writing about, or to the unconscious, or, you know, they kind of take you back, and that's why it's really important to have art and poetry and music and that, because it keeps those valves open to the windows of the soul open. Mm-hmm. They don't get closed over.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I love that idea about the myths being the soul's history.
Yeah.
A different kind of history and more unconscious, as you say, more but part of the collective unconscious.
Yeah, because they say that after a while, things just do get relegated to memory. You know, they become legends, right? They mm-hmm. They aren't really factual anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So characters become mythologized. You know, Jesus becomes mythologized, and you know, as an example, Buddha. You know, all these people become gods because the gods are the archetypes, right? So it's interesting how that happens.
Mm-hmm.
I was noticing you have a lot of interesting women in the book. Like the Poison Maiden, for example. That's a really interesting one. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, Poison Maiden is a good example. Poison Maiden is one poem with a strong, interesting woman in it. It's quite complex. I can also talk about another strong woman in Alexander's time. Her name was Thais. Thais was described as a beautiful courtesan, and she was blamed for standing up drunk at a banquet and inciting the Greeks to burn down Persepolis. Persepolis was the Persian palace, mm-hmm. home of culture, and they had just captured this palace. So there's always been, and there still is, this conflicting impulse for the victor in war to either destroy the other culture completely or to absorb it, take it over, take the advantage of the other culture and make it their own. And I think that speaks to the territorial nature of men. And in this case, the historians writing about Persepolis afterwards, which they did, quite a lot of them, blame it all on the woman, Thais.
Mm-hmm. Actually, that makes interesting connection to what we were talking about with myth. When they conquer a place, they always have to destroy the statues of the old gods, or mm-hmm. take their noses off and stuff and replace them. They don't completely replace, but they change it. Like they turn, like for instance, you see Buddha's, the image we know of Buddha is actually Apollo that Alexander had
wow.
brought. And before that, apparently, I think, Buddha wasn't actually depicted as a human. It was more like just feet or a tree, you know, symbolic. Mm. But the whole, when Alexander came to India and all these areas, he brought all his gods with him, you know, and so you get these pictures of Buddha, you look at his hair and everything, they're exactly like the old pictures of Apollo.
Yeah, amazing way of absorbing the cultural icons. Mm-hmm. The victor, that's what the victor does, in this case. Mm-hmm. You chose which poems to illustrate. You've mentioned several of them. Can you say what appealed to you or why you chose a particular poem?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure why, but when I think about it, I guess they were just the ones with a personal resonance that immediately formed images in my mind. Honestly, that's how I tend to go with it. It's just there. It just speaks to me. And so then I go, oh, well, then I don't have to think about it much. I just have to see if it will come out. Also, if it's potentially a piece that I can insert some myth or symbolism into, or some of my own interests. For example, in Poison Maiden, again, I depicted her as a Naga, an Indian Naga, because I really like mythological beasties, especially the anthropomorphic female ones. So, and it was perfect for that poem. So I thought, well, here's my opportunity to do a nice
yes.
Naga. Also, did you mention style?
This is a good place to talk about style, actually.
Yeah, I tried to make it very graphic at first, like a very light, graphic, crisp style, and mm-hmm. It just wasn't coming out that way. So then the images the poems that I chose kind of had to go with the style that I was envisioning, which was quite soft and quite dreamy. And actually all of them did, but some of them just really emerged that way.
And I think some of them are quite different. For example, the one about horses is quite striking looking and has less detail in it than mm-hmm. the one that you were mentioning, the Poison Maiden illustration.
Right. Yeah. Well, because, again, it's the landscape is different. When I put myself, as you do, back in time, you know, I think of the Mongolian plains. They are very sparse like mm-hmm. that, and the shadows would be very long sunset, and it would be very contrasty, you know. And then it on an Indian riverbank, you know, in the evening it would be kind of misty and, well, maybe not, maybe it would be clear, but in my mind it was kind of misty and illusion everywhere, you know, this, mm-hmm. the poison maiden coming down the river, mm-hmm. and this sort of illusory effect and snakes.
Illusory and full of interesting, perhaps, dangerous
danger,
kind of
yeah,
details potential. And vegetation. And
yeah, just kind of much more, you know, dreamlike, dreamscape. But mm-hmm. the Mongolian one would seem to me much more clear and open, mm-hmm. you know, so I just worked with that.
Mm-hmm. And they look good, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Julie, you pay a lot of attention, speaking of landscape, you pay a lot of attention to landscape in your poems. Some writers see the landscape as another character. So what's your interest in landscape? Do you see it this way? Or
I think that's a brilliant idea, landscape as a character in itself. Landscape is important to me, and it's important in war. It's very different for me from the way British Romantic poets, for example, appreciate the landscape, even if I do love flowers and trees as much as they did. But when I wrote about the Battle of Crecy in August 1346, there's a line I wrote, "Dirt geometry clinches destiny." And to me, understanding the landscape is part of the battle strategy. In other words, when and where is a good place to fight. So many military initiatives are planned for summer. King Edward of England could start the Hundred Years' War on a weekend in August, actually last weekend, because he considered it to be the perfect time, and Crecy was a perfect battle location with a wooded hill and a plain spreading out in front, so a good place to fight. But then in any landscape, there's also weather, rain, cold, snow, and literally the fog of war. In winter, what's not growing on the landscape is food. So in the past, in China and in Russia, the enemy could just use starvation mm-hmm. as a prime strategy.
Interesting.
In that way. And there's other of the poems as well, I think readers will see, use the impact and the influence of weather, mm-hmm. darkness, tornadoes, all of that. And weather has always been really important to me. I guess living in Vancouver, weather's important. Everyone's happy when it's sunny.
Now smoke is part of the weather.
And smoke is part of the weather, right, because yeah. of the fires, yeah. So incredibly, it was extremely important in terms of how battles were won and lost as well.
Interesting.
So let's talk about other illustrators or other writers that we like.
Okay.
What are some of your favorite illustrators, past or present?
Oh, probably more. I could probably name more past ones because, to be honest, these days I don't look at that much illustration. How bad of me is that? But I look a lot to classical antiquity and primitive art and all kinds of other things. But when I was starting out, my heroes, I mean, it was in the 80s, so there was a real golden age of illustration going on. A lot of conceptual illustration, mm-hmm. illustrators getting freedom to use their ideas and their different styles. So I was born into this era with illustrators like Blair Drossin, Anita Kunz, Henrik Drescher.
I like some of those people, too. Yeah, mm-hmm. still enjoy looking at their illustrated books.
What poets do you like?
I like poets for wonderful and specific things that they do. I like every poem Don MacKay writes about birds, as I also wrote a nonfiction book about birds myself, The Herons of Stanley Park.
Oh, yes.
And I like Christian Bach's poetry about minerals and about science. It's quite avant-garde, really, really interesting poet. I like Carol Ann Duffy, who was the poet laureate in Britain, for her sensuous and smart poems about love. And I have written lots of love poems. I like the Japanese poet Chiyo Ni. She was a haiku master in the 1700s in Japan. famous from the age of 17, and she lived till about 72. I like her images of nature, and I do have a special love for haiku. But haiku have restrictions as to the form, of course, you probably know, but also subject matter, tone, reference, all of those are restricted in haiku. So I write haiku, but I can't write everything in a haiku. For example, I used many different poetic forms in 27 Stings, no haiku. In one poem, I described Operation Quicksilver, which was a totally fake village that the British created around Dover in 1944. And it was a deception to make the Germans think that British soldiers were right there getting ready to attack Calais. So it was a fabricated world with lights turning on and off and dummy tanks and fake kitchens and simulated military practice. One line in the poem is, "They heard a life thick and luscious." And this is how some of the poems have to be, given the subject matter. So getting back to types of poetry that I like, I feel this sort of poems that I had to write in 27 Stings are not haiku, they're not imagistic and minimal. They're much denser.
Well, when is the book coming out?
November 11th, Remembrance Day. I love it.
How fitting.
It's a little bit late in the fall, but it's really quite appropriate.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think this is really the kind of thing that needs to be read around Remembrance Day, because it does make people remember, even if they were never there, you know, remember way into the distant past.
Mm-hmm. Well, this reminds me of one of your illustrations to the poems near the end of the book about fire, and it's I think people are going to think about that when they look at the illustration as well.
Mm-hmm.
We won't give away what it looks
no.
like, but... Speaking of style, we were talking about your illustrations. Tell me more about style and working with different styles.
Well, you mentioned that this book, the poems, couldn't be a haiku because of the subject matter.
Right.
And it's sort of similar with how I chose to do the illustrations, or how they chose to be done. I work in a variety of styles. I mean, from little whimsical drawings that people know me for, mostly, to very painterly. I do a lot of painting, collage, icons, all kinds of things. So I just have to see what the subject matter dictates. So like the fact that it couldn't be a haiku, I'm having another book that I illustrated published this fall with Bill Richardson, and it's poems, but they're dark humor, but they're light, and it is a small book, and it's what was called for was more light, whimsical line illustrations. So this book and his book and your book are at completely different ends of the spectrum, and the style is completely different. You wouldn't even think it was done by the same person, but it's the mentality that's the same throughout all of them. But yeah, you know, you have to really let the subject matter dictate.
That sounds like the nature of art to me.
I think so, yeah.
Well, some of your covers, though, are iconic, I think.
I like icons or iconism because I think you have, you know, it's kind of like shooting an arrow. You know, you just want to, you have a few seconds to get to someone at a very deep level and to also to reach as many people as possible. So it has to be a striking, simple image. At least that's how I work. I mean, not all illustrators are the same, but I just go with what the writing is telling me. It's a matter of just zapping people between the eyes. The strong, no frills kind of image.
Zapping people between the eyes. That sounds kind of like 27 Stings.
Well, yeah, I'm a bit of a warrior when it comes to the old illustrating, you know?
Sounds similar. Are there any other projects that you have right now that are not a secret?
Well, this one that I just mentioned is going to be out in October, so it's not really a secret. It's called The First Little Bastard to Call Me Gramps, and it's by Bill Richardson. And then I always have all my own things that I'm trying to get off the ground, you know? How about you?
Similarly, I find collaborating really interesting. And
I
am working on a, and this has been really a fun collaboration with our separate but amazing strengths. I am working on another collaboration now with someone that's a kind of multimedia project. And at the same time, like you, I have my own projects. I'm still writing. I'm working on my novel, my third novel, actually. Mm. And as far as poetry, I always write poetry, usually about love or war. I'm not sure that there's going to be a second volume of 27 Stings called Even More Stings or 28 Plus Stings or One More Sting.
The last sting.
Lots of possibilities, yes, there that I haven't exploited. But it's because I got so deeply into the lives of the people and the ideas and the landscape when I was writing those poems, it's a bit exhausting. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I will write more of them and publish them. So I'm happy with the couple years that I spent doing this book. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad that it has the graphics component that I want, with extra special surprising illustrations from you. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I kind of wondered, you know, you always wonder what the writer's going to make of what the illustrator did with their work. It's always a surprise, you know? So I'm glad you like them.
I think I'll finish then by reading a poem. This is the first one I wrote, and it was after reading the book by Sun Tzu called The Art of War. It's a manual of war he wrote in ancient China 2,500 years ago. Really thinking about this now in terms of what I've understood, it's just amazing how much intelligence and effort and creativity is put into strategies for war. Could be in other things, but it's put into war still today, of course.
Yeah.
The Art of War, the book, has strict rules about what to do, and people have been using these strategies in it ever since. They even write books about how to succeed in business using the Art of War strategies. I researched a battle that took place in the year about 750, and I was interested in the strategies the people used and the general used in that time. I wrote a poem about it, and the original title of the poem was Strategies. Then I imagined very specifically what it was like for those people, and I called the poem Straw Men. So I'm going to read that poem right now. Straw Men, circa 756, Yangchu, China. No food, no weapons. We had nothing but straw. Countless rebel soldiers were climbing the wall. We lit the straw bales on the edge and pushed them over. Men fell in flames. There was a smell of grilled meat. In the fields, we caught sparrows and rats to eat. General Zhang said, dummies. But boys could not craft something out of nothing. So women rolled 1,000 men from straw, trimmed the torsos, plumped the bellies, tied sticks between the legs, cinched heads, made thick, twitchy arms. We had no arrows. We leashed the thousands and waited in our beds. In the dark, the dummies were lowered down the gate, and soldiers shot them. We pulled out bloodless arrows, armed our men, and boiled weeds. General Zhang said, warriors, eat, and later, tonight, slip down. The second time, the soldiers smirked. So we ran over and set their tents on fire. We cooked our rice with shredded paper, and then we ate the horses. The next battle, we ate bark. We didn't have the power to fight back. One woman was precious. General Zhang said, concubine, come here. She was fat and lazy. That was fatal. Every bit of her was shared amongst us. We chewed our dinner and didn't wonder who comes next, for who had offered her and saved us? No straw man, our hero, General Zhang. Thank you, Roxana, for coming and helping me talk about the book and the illustrations. Thank you, Amy.
Well, everybody, I just want to say that Julie's poems are really amazing and inspiring, so buy a book.
You can take out that part.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining the Happy Hour Symposium. Stay tuned for next episodes by other New Star authors. You can also stay in the loop by liking our Facebook page, New Star Books, or you can follow us on Twitter at New Star Books. A special thank you to Emerson and Bigadarov, as well as the VPL for making their resources available to us. Visit our website to pre-order 27 Stings and other titles at newstarbooks.com.